The last session of this great conference. So the first talk is by Bianca, and she will talk about 3D holography.
Thank you to the organizers to invite me to give a talk here. And fortunately, I might have even something to speak about related to this conference. And it's things we started to think about very recently. So it's actually more also still in a proposal form, some part of it. And there's a concrete calculation, which I will present. And the motivation is actually also to provide a relationship between discrete approaches and continuum approaches. And in the way of tensor network approaches, they are also discrete. And other approaches which are really continuum. And so the setting here will be 3D quantum gravity, mostly, I mean, in the concrete applications, concrete calculation will be in a Euclidean setting. And the aim, as I said, is to provide a concrete model for holography in this context. And I'm really using 3D quantum gravity, so holography is here a bit different from the usual meaning, because the puzzle is much more how to get from a topological field theory to a conformal field theory. And the aim is really to use, in this context, the topological nature of 3D quantum gravity. So we will basically work with a concrete realization of 3D quantum gravity. And as I say, the puzzle is to understand better, or actually, you know, provide a concrete model where one sees this effect, how to obtain a conformal field theory, especially if one is actually working with a discretization. And the further motivation is actually what has not been really, there has not been really done work on this in, say, loop quantum gravity, which is to understand ADS-CFT correspondence in a non-perturbative approach. And one, I mean, a couple of difficulties is, one is to understand how to work at infinite boundaries, and can one really just work at finite boundaries? So that's an open question. And another difficulty is actually to work with ADS. And indeed, in this talk, I will circumvent that. Also, one can actually easily generalize everything which is done here to ADS. So the paper which actually sparked our interest in this thing was actually a very recent one by Barnish, Gonzalez, Maloney, and Oblak. And they computed the one loop correction to the partition function of 3D gravity just with standard Euclidean gravity, as you can say. And you can argue that this should give a certain result, namely character of the BMS group, and that was also very recently figured out what this character is. But to recap a bit the history, so these things go back to basically the paper which can be seen as a precursor to ADS-CFT by Brown and Hano, which studied the symmetries at infinity for ADS space and found that the algebra of the charges has a central extension and gives you a Virasoro algebra. And so basically this computation is actually also just a specification or another a limit of this computation in 2008, which was computing the one loop partition function for EDS and also reproduced basically this character of the Virasoro algebra, which you get in this case. And Barnish is basically, since some time, he's really interested in this figuring out the Virasoro algebra and the charge algebra at infinity. And recently, he basically considered this limit to flat space. And so I think you can say it culminated in figuring out what is the character and what should you expect, and that as a result of the partition function. And that was confirmed in this calculation. And so let me just recap this calculation, because that was really done in the continuum theory. And it's considering the partition function on a background which is thermal spinning flat space. So this 3D gravity is flat. the equations of motion are just flatness. So what you do, you take flat space, here it is. You write it in cylindrical coordinates, that's here. And the only particular thing is you do a periodic identification in time direction. That gives you the thermal property. And the other thing is you do a Dehn twist for the torus, and you get this angle alpha. So that is, you just twist a bit your periodic identification, and probably I will call alpha twist, but in general, apparently it's called angular potential. And then you get basically this torus as a boundary, and for this is actually a solid torus, so basically you have r equal to zero, and that's basically the center circle here in this for this torus. And so what you want to do is to study this partition function for infinite radius in principle. So that means that the only parameters you have are these temperature beta and the angular potential. And for this torus, you just define the so-called moduli parameter for this torus. Okay, and the classical evaluation of this partition of the action is quite trivial. in the flat case, because the bulk term vanishes, it's flat. You have this boundary term. And this is the integral over the extrinsic curvature. Now, extrinsic curvature is just 1 over r. If you integrate it over the cylinder, you just get a constant, and basically you just get the area of the torus. So it's proportional to beta, because the area of this torus does not depend on this angular twist. It's just given by beta times 2 pi. Okay, so the rather more non-trivial part is the computation of the one loop correction, which is basically given by the linearized action and the hashing of this linearized action. So you just need to evaluate the determinant of this hessian of your action. And the determinant, this hessian of the action will be basically given by a bunch of Laplacians in case you actually gauge fix. So this computation is really done in the field theoretic sense that you consider basically gauge fixing and have also ghost fields. And then you basically have to evaluate this is basically already the result for kind of the effective action correction coming from one loop. And so you get this combination of these different Laplacians, which come from spin 2, so the actual graviton, and the others you can, all these terms are actually just induced by gauge fixing because you don't really have a spin 2 and 3D gravity propagating. But if you do that, you get also vector and a scalar contribution. And so you would have to figure out what this is. And this you can do by heat kernel regularization. And so basically, what you do is you have to find the so-called heat kernel, which satisfies a differential equation, which is basically this on the left-hand side and the time derivative on the right-hand side. So it's kind of standard technique. And in EDS, apparently, that was a bit more problematic because the guys had first to find the spin 2 version of the seed kernel, and they did it. In flat space, apparently it's known. And so you can just take the heat kernel for R3. Then what you actually need is a heat kernel on this solid torus. So what you do is to use the method of images, which is actually to sum the heat kernel over all translations of your discrete symmetry group. And that actually leads to the sum structure of the result, or here it's a product structure. and so you do that, and you get slightly complicated, results, and add everything up, and the end result after regularization and so on is this simple formula, which is a product. Interestingly, it starts only with k equal to 2 of 1 minus q to the power of k, where q is just a parameter for this angular potential. Okay. Okay, so here you use really field theoretic computation for kind of a very simple theory, which is a topological theory. So the question is, can one actually make use of the topological nature of the theory? And can you turn that into a calculation to give your, say, undergrad student who just knows how to calculate with matrices? And it would be also nice because in the end, you know, why do you get this result at all? It happens that, that not all one loop contributions cancel. So it would be nice to understand actually better what are exactly the contributing degrees of freedom and why do you get the structure of the result. So in 3D, making use of this topological nature would, of course, simplify any approach to computing such a similar partition function in a completely non-perturbative approach. And this, indeed, we see as the first step to go further and do it, say, in for spin forms. And to also understand this puzzle and how to get field theory on the boundary from this topological theory. And that comes more from being used to 3D gravity being topological. You would, you know, think you just, everything is discretization independent, so you would not really expect a field theory.
So what is K? I mean, I know it was in this formula, but is there,
it will be interpreted later, exactly.
Okay. It's part of this understanding.
It will be part of this understanding. And this calculation is not exactly one-to-one because the summation terms come from the method over images. So if you want to have something invariant under the discrete group, you just add, sum over all actions of this group, kind of a group averaging. But then you get actually a more complicated result and you can rewrite that into this one. And the more complicated result, for instance, the summation starts with n equal 1, and here it's k equal to 2. But we will see k will be actually exactly the modes, as we will see.
So you say you regulate this with the mass term.
Uh-huh.
Is it obvious that, that is the right thing to do? Because, for example, in the case of a scalar field, if you have different IR regulators, you get different answers. For example, periodic scalar field is not the same as the limit of a massive field.
I mean,
I
have only seen the paper. I've read the paper, and there it worked out because it gives you exactly the result you expect. You know, and they put the mass to zero. So I haven't really checked the details of the calculation, but I have it in the background. So it's only also just 4 pages. So, indeed, I'm not the field theory guy, so. I do this calculation now in a much simpler context, in a sense, and that's Ricci calculus. And it's actually and for 3D, it's very nice. I mean, okay, 3D is flat, but it's a very geometric discretization of general relativity. As the name suggests, it was put up by Ricci, who also unfortunately died recently last fall. And more seriously, this is a classical version of the so-called Ponzano-Ricci model. And this Ponzano-Ricci model is from 1968. It was published in a completely obscure book on atomic physics or something. And it's basically the first spinform model, and it's actually also the first topological phase, if you want. and it turned out to be really the a very reasonable model for 3D quantum gravity. so if you're a condensed matter guy, this is just a version of a topological phase. It's just a bit unusual that you work with SU2, which is a, in principle, has infinite dimensional representation theory. Okay, so what do? You discretize, you choose a discretization of general relativity. And it's allowed, you can take an arbitrary triangulation. And to encode the geometry of this triangulation, you assign length variables to the edges of this triangulation. And this specifies uniquely a piecewise flat geometry. and so what you have to do with this thing is to provide a dynamics, which is done by giving this Ricci action. And this Ricci action is really this ingenious piece of insight because as we will see, it actually turns out to give you the Hamilton-Jacobi function of the continuum. And this is a rejection. So if you have never seen these things, so this is just the curvature term. And in 2D, this, you see the curvature coming from the so-called deficit angle. So in 3D, you just add one dimension here, and this would sit around an edge. And also, the nice thing is that the curvature, the boundary terms appear very natural, because this boundary angle is just another version of this deficit angle. So instead of 2 pi, you just take pi here. So this is the rejection, and the epsilons you can express as functions of the length. It's a bit complicated expressions, but that doesn't matter. And an important point is that you can actually rewrite these contributions almost as a sum over tetrahedra. Modulo basically these contributions which are assigned to edges and will basically drop out in the Hessian. but what is this tetrahedra contribution? It is given as a length times this dihedral angle, which is exactly the boundary term which we have seen previously. And actually, it is exactly the Hamilton-Jacobi function of continuum GR for tetrahedral boundary data. So if you would compute this term for this funny boundary data, saying these triangles are flat, and you put basically an angle here, that means you have only non-vanishing contributions of k along these edges. You integrate over the edges, this gives you length L, and this is just the dihedral angle, which is the extrinsic curvature. okay, and 3D gravity is flat, so the bulk term vanishes. And the same holds in 4D, at least for one simplex. So that's the genius of Regge, basically. Here we also show in one line that the entire theory in 3D is completely independent of the triangulation, as you would expect. So this is the Regge action. You vary the edge length, and the only thing you have to worry about would be basically the variation of the epsilon 10 of the deficit angle. If you have ever varied the Einstein-Hilbert action, you might remember that the variation of the curvature term vanishes there. If you have not in the discrete, this follows from the so-called Schlefli identity, which is actually exactly the discrete analog of this identity which you have in the continuum. And because of this identity, the only variation you get and survives is from this length variables here. So variation of the Regge action is just deficit angles times the length variables, variation of the length variables. So putting these to zero, you just find that 3D gravity is flat, as you expect. And then you can go back and evaluate your solution on the Regge action. So you just remain with the boundary term as in the continuum. And indeed, this is the Hamilton-Jacobi function of continuum GR again, for piecewise flat boundary data. And you also see that's independent of a choice of bulk triangulation.
So it seems it's sort of essential that you're at zero cosmological
constant. Yeah, but there were ingenious people which defined it for, no, sorry. I mean, we defined it recently for homogeneously curved things. So you have the same effect there for homogeneous curved things. And how we got to there is to via coarse graining, actually. So that's very nice. And indeed, we want to extend it to the one loop partition function. And there's basically, I think, at least three different quantization approaches came out of Regge calculus. One is kind of maybe the oldest version, and you can call it quantum Regge calculus. The other is the Ponzano Regge model. A third one is dynamical triangulations, which in 2D are exactly matrix models. And we don't do the matrix models because these are indeed not triangulation invariant because you sum over all triangulations. But this is Regge calculus, so you would write the partition function as an integral over all edge lengths and just an Euclidean version of this path integral. Unfortunately, you know, it's very hard to actually do that numerically, and some people did it or do it, and somehow the results are a bit debated. And indeed, a long-standing heated debate with a few people which were doing that is on the correct measure. you have to choose, which you can argue is basically the main point of actually doing non-perturbative quantum gravity. It completely can change the properties of your theory. Now we are in 3D, the theory is triangulation invariant. So basically we propose one should choose this measure such that at least in linearized gravity, this theory is also triangulation invariant. And the question is if such a local measure does indeed exist, and the claim is if it exists, and indeed gives again the one loop correction of the continuum theory for tetrahedral boundary data. And the nice thing indeed, it exists and it even has been calculated. And so what you actually have to do, it's there's a very nice mechanism for that, which has been proposed by Koropanov, is to figure out what is the Hessian for local changes of the triangulation. And here you see one of these local changes that you subdivide the tetrahedron and integrate out these bulk triangles. And what you want is that basically your partition function is invariant under this change, under integrating out these bulk triangles. And you find indeed that you can calculate the Hessian. And so you can calculate what is the measure, and you find indeed you can come up with this local measure, which gives you complete triangulation invariance. And it also matches nicely the asymptotics of the Ponzano-Recce amplitude for one tetrahedron, and the Ponzano-Recce spin form model is indeed also triangulation invariant in a certain sense. So now indeed we know what is actually the one loop correction also in this case for a tetrahedral boundary data. Because imagine you would basically subdivide your tetrahedron very finely and integrate out. You know that the result you could write down immediately because of the triangulation independence of this measure, it would be just this result. So that means that for an arbitrary large tetrahedron, we can actually compute the one-loop partition function without computing. So let me mention some other thing which would be quite somewhat important, and that is the notion of diffeomorphic symmetry in Recce calculus. It was a bit confusing because people thought, oh, you put length variables on the edges. It specifies a piecewise linear geometry without a metric. So somehow there should be no diffeomorphic symmetry. But in fact, if you look at this example and take a tetrahedral boundary data, and you subdivide this tetrahedra again with one vertex, you know all the solutions, and the solutions, all they have to satisfy is to be flat. So you take your tetrahedra, you put your vertex anywhere you want, and you get a family of solutions. Non-uniqueness of solutions with fixed boundary data defines gauge symmetry. So this, in fact, is diffeomorphic symmetry. And here you have an active point that you really move the vertices around in your triangulation. and so if you linearize, these will be null modes of your Hessian. And you can see that indeed as a discrete remnant of your diffeomorphic symmetry. And that's exactly the symmetry which actually turns Recce calculus into a topological theory, of course. Unfortunately, in 4D, that was a bit the debate about, these symmetries are broken if you go to curved solutions, because it's very hard to write a general curved tetrahedron stuff. so let me remark, that was William's question. It's now kind of straightforward to include the cosmological constant. The calculations will be actually quite similar. If you just change piecewise flat tetrahedra to homogeneously curved tetrahedra, And it will be, I mean, I was standing here, it will be interesting to look at the full non-perturbative version. To some extent, people have done that in the context of BTZ black hole. It's a bit of a puzzle that the BTZ black hole, you need EDS, and the non-perturbative spin form is not well defined, but you can ignore that or do analytical continuation. But for this, we will identify a feature which hasn't been considered so far, namely that indeed you need to take some kind of continuum limit, and this has not been done so far. Okay, so let us just redo this calculation. And the question to answer is basically, can we take a boundary at finite radius? So somehow, at actually for flat case, you can immediately argue, yes, you can. So it will be actually more a question for EDS. Do we need to take the continuum limit for the boundary? That's maybe what you expect if you want to see conformal field theories there. And does it really work? You know. So let me just go through the setup. So we choose a triangulation which we could think of as the simplest one for this in this context, which still allows to capture, I mean, to take, in, if it's needed, the continuum limit on the boundary. So we take the cylinder and cut it kind of in first cake pieces, and you can also take arbitrarily many time steps. And so each building block here is actually a prism. And this prism can be triangulated via three tetrahedra. And so you have three different lengths here. This is kind of the length of in the angular direction. You have this radius, which should be big at some point. You guess that L should be at least zero, small. And T is a bit unclear what you have to do with T at this point. So if you glue n pieces of these together, you want to get a flat solution. And the condition for getting a flat solution is that this ratio is equal to this number where n is the number of pieces. Okay. Yeah, let me mention, of course, the evaluation of the classical wedge action is straightforward, and you can do that with any triangulation. And the reason is that this extrinsic curvature is basically something like an invariant, topological invariant on this, in this case, like Gauss-Bonnet type thing. So for this, you wouldn't need any continuum limit, but it's not so interesting. so now let's see if that works. Again, basically what we need to know is the Hessian, and the Hessian, okay, we have to compute. So it's basically given us a as a derivative of your dihedral angles. And in 3D, the first thing one which one notices, if one computes, for instance, this Hessian for this prism, then you get a scale-free or a dimension-free matrix. And you just get these scaling factors, and the scaling factors have a very similar structure to the measure factor, which I showed before very shortly. So if you do a variable transformation, these factors get almost all canceled by the measure term. And this is only to show that basically this matrix is quite simple, and the only parameter which appears is A, which is this ratio between L and R. And this is actually already the simple argument that you don't need to take R to infinity as long as L is sufficiently small. But it's actually just a case for 3D flat gravity of a point one for Ratchet, because the solutions are kind of invariant under rescaling. Okay. Yeah, this has already some null vectors, and they correspond actually to the scaling symmetry. It looks a bit more useful if you basically really glue these prisms together. Okay, then looks a bit complicated, but it's here already has lots of structure. So what we do is to reorganize our variables. So imagine you put a lattice on your cylinder, And so you have an angular coordinate, angular step size, and you have a time coordinate. So time coordinate will be n, s will be the angular step, and for this angular direction, we take a Fourier transform. And so you have three type of variables. There are lots of these diagonal edges and the radial edges. And on the time axis, we have just one per time step time-like edges. And we here we already put all boundary fluctuations to zero. Okay, and that's the result. So one already sees something like this term, for instance. You see that T XR is a Lagrange multiplier, and in fact is given by the lattice function. So T is actually the lattice, which is very geometric. The lattice gives you the difference between two time slices. And indeed, integrating over this lattice, this is a Lagrange multiplier. There's no other term. There's no quadratic term in T. If you integrate over, it will put this zero mode of your radial component to zero. Then we already have a Laplacian in angular direction. So that's quite nice because we expect something non-trivial. It's a bit puzzling that there's not too much of a coupling between time slices because these are the only two terms which couple between time slices and they come multiplied with A, which in principle is a small parameter. And these terms, they just come from this twist identification. So they only come with if n is basically equal to zero. So for the point where you identify n equal to zero to n equal to number of time steps.
So you're just on a torus, right? Is there a reason why you want to treat one direction differently from the other?
Like I'm just doing a general direction, a general calculation. Do you mean because of the Fourier transform?
Yeah, why do you Fourier transform only in space?
Yeah, no, because it was easier to do it this way. And Fourier transform in space was in time was not very clear because of this periodic thing you do. I mean, this angular twist. But anyway, it doesn't matter. You could do the other thing too. But indeed, here there was no obvious Laplacian yet in time direction. okay, so basically. You can take this and confirm that you have these null vectors you expect. And here's one important point. So you can compute geometrically what are the null vectors you want to have. And so one is to move this vertex in the radial, in the equal t plane. And there are two directions. So you would expect two modes. And in fact, the modes are exactly at k equal to plus one and k equal to minus one. And the other thing you can do is to move this vertex vertically. And this actually just affects the time variables, which are not so important, it's the lattice, and these diagonal edges. And this is only at zero mode because all diagonal edges are changed in the same way. So we don't really have any bulk extent of gauge symmetries. We only have these three modes. And now you see actually how already these three modes will drop out and explain this funny result that the product only starts at k equal to 2. so indeed, I was first for some time a bit puzzled how I should ever get a reasonable time coupling. But the mysterious things happens if you integrate out the R variables. which you can do because there's no gauge mode which only affects the R variables. Then what you get is that actually the terms in zeros order in A vanish. And so you get only A and A squared terms. And da we get our lattice Laplacian in time direction. This funny twist identification. And that was kind of important to get any dependence on this angular twist parameter. And then we get this funny prefactor, which will not be important because this will go to zero in this continuum limit. And here, so this lattice Laplacian is just this kind of matrix. And it turns out that the determinant of such a matrix is given by basically this easy function as a function of alpha, and you also see that this gives 0 for alpha equal to 0. So if you don't have any twist, we get a singular result, and indeed that was also a feature of the continuum thing, and you actually, what happens if you don't have a twist is indeed that this is a free particle and you have a time translation symmetry or it's basically a constant mode in T which gives you the zero. Now you put everything together and compute this determinant of M minus the modes which give you zero. And here you again see that this gives you zero if you put k equal to plus or minus one, because A is basically the same as this lattice Laplacian for k equal to plus or minus one. So you get just the product over these factors, which is here. And you get some other things which all kind of vanish in the limit where A is zero. And A equal to zero, that was again basically the ratio between L and R. So if R, either you send R to infinity or you send L to zero, which gives you continuum limit in angular direction. Okay? So actually, the number of time steps never appeared. So the interesting thing is we don't need any continuum limit in time direction, because actually it's just a free particle. The free particle you can kind of discretize via so-called perfect discretization, which means that you can do that without any time discretization. So it makes, of course, direct use of your topological nature of the series. So we get these gauge modes only at k equal to 0, plus 1, and minus 1. And that explains why we start here with k equal to 2. And indeed, this is just Laplacian in time direction. And you multiply it for the different modes, k, which we got. Okay. So we basically, it's clear that the contributing, it wasn't clear before, that the contributing degrees of freedom kind of sit at the boundary, because what we integrated, what we discretized is just the angular direction. So it's basically that these are the edges are very long in principle, but it's just the fluctuations. So it's kind of the only thing which contributes. And we don't really have any discretization in radial direction. And the computation in general, you can do that for ADS and DS, and will maybe convince you that using ratchet calculus, at least to do this kind of computation, is quite useful. And one interesting thing now would be actually to look at the same in the full non-perturbative model, and indeed, in these limities, it's possible to look at this Ponsano-Ratchet model, or at least at the so-called semi-classical limit, if sufficiently many edges can be scaled to be large. And here, we can indeed scale sufficiently many edges to be large. Okay, so this was kind of the calculation which convinced us that it works, if it wasn't here before, but we had to check. But maybe more interesting is really to look at the boundary fluctuations, which we haven't done in detail yet. So we have done the simplest triangulation, and so far I haven't shown you the boundary fluctuations, and I won't today. But in principle, you could actually discretize it also in radial direction. And here you would basically see one equal time slice, where you get different building blocks. One are these squares, which have the propagate kind of the same number of degrees of freedom in a sense, and the other are these prisms, which we already had. So this is quite similar to a Mera network, and if you basically now really take it in 3D in the time direction and do a periodic identification, this is indeed a map from the Hilbert space here at the smaller cylinder to the larger cylinder. From a smaller torus to larger torus, and just kind of holographic renormalization in a simple case. what one had to do is, what would be indeed interesting is to see whether and how one can get indeed a conformal field theory at the boundary. And there are further directions to explore. Indeed, the work of Barnish is a lot about writing down the charges, which are basically the generators for the symmetries. And these are even quite well understood for the bulk case in the discrete setting. It's highly non-trivial usually because discretization completely destroys any kind of algebra you usually have, but because of this topological nature of the theory, if you're clever enough, you can actually get them as a closed algebra. And so this is again something where you can do very concrete things and ask whether you can get a realization of the Virasoro algebra, but in this case on the lattice. And actually very recently this has been indeed considered to study discrete realizations of the Virasoro algebra even at finite lattice lengths. Okay, so this is a bit of future things, but indeed these things are very concrete and easy to calculate. So I'm already almost at the end of my talk. So actually for me, it was the first time that the discrete calculation turned out to be simpler than the continuum calculation. I spent much time in the discrete and it's usually a huge pain. but it's really using some ingenious things. I mean, as we have written this paper on the measure, we didn't talk of any application of this in this context. But indeed, it is the genius of these things is that you can apply it to really large things in principle because you are triangulation invariant. So if you can think of any other applications, at least in 3D, we can make this calculation probably easier than with field theoretic methods because it's something you need to, you know, it's just a bit of matrix algebra. So this is more the future thing to look at the boundary fluctuations and see what happens. And the nice thing is that, okay, actually it uses a topological field theory. It uses a topological field theory, which is, I didn't mention that, but the Ponzano-Reggie model is actually really a version or implementation of BF theory, which is exactly the topological model which is used in condensed matter. And for positive cosmological constant, you get a quantum group deformation, and that's actually used in condensed matter because for SE2, you get some infinities which come from diffeomorphic symmetry. indeed, this shows basically this power of perfect discretizations, which are not really discretizations because they give you the continuum result, the kind of effective actions where you already integrated out all things. And there's a framework to make it all more precise. And the nice thing is that this could provide a nice model to illustrate this framework, but I'm not going to talk much about this framework. And there are many further directions to explore. So one is to really study the dynamics of the boundary fluctuations in the flat case and in the EDS. For BTZ black holes, indeed, there seems to be long ongoing work by, for instance, Caleb to exactly identify what are the degrees of freedom responsible for the entropy of the BTZ black hole. And I think the difficulty is that he wants to do it at the horizon, really, in Minkowski signature. And it's not obvious to do that for the null surface. So at least he could try to play around with this. This type of calculation you can do for De Sitter if you know what you want to compute in De Sitter. I mentioned this application to quantization, to the full quantum models or spinform models, or to Reviro would be actually this topological phases. And here it's really that you use a topological phase to, for instance, get this conformal field theory. So an interesting question is, can we apply it to 4D? 4D is not topological. So you would need to take the full continuum limit. And in 4D, actually, there was an interesting puzzling question, which is, 4D Ratchet calculus is still invariant under some kind of local changes of your triangulation. So the question is, could you get the measure also to be invariant under these type of local changes of the triangulation? And the answer is no. And it's really also very funny geometric calculation and interpretation which comes in. And a completely obscure determinant which tells you whether 5 vertices are on a sphere or something, which tells you no. But by comparing the corresponding computing continuum computation with any kind of discrete calculation you do and taking the continuum limit, you might at least, you know, fix some features of this measure, which would be also interesting, but in principle, it's also, I mean, of course, Ratchet is just a lattice approach, so you can do any, try to do any computation in this lattice approach, but of course, it's a question whether it's any simpler than a complete continuum calculation. Okay, so thank you.
Any questions?
I was confused by what you were telling me about 4D. Mm-hmm. So Ratchet calculus is just the discretization of the geometry, mm-hmm. but still. So what is it that's not working?
It's not triangulation invariant.
Not triangulation invariant.
And there are different, so changes of the triangulation can be organized in local moves. And these are, I don't know, 5-1, 3-2, and 3-3, and these are just, you know, telling you what kind of moves they are. And under two of these moves,
yeah.
like the action is invariant in the sense that, for instance, the 5-1 move, you take one simplex and subdivide it, and in four dimensions you get five simplices. But one simplex has certain boundary data, and the solution for these boundary data is you are flat. So in this case, indeed, you just get the same kind of action, the same Hamilton-Jacobi function, and the theory is, in this sense, is invariant under this move. And you could ask, can you at least define a measure, a local measure, which is invariant just on this under this move? And the answer is no. So you can see that as kind of anomaly, or that actually you already, which was surprising for us, you need already a non-local action for this kind of symmetry, which might not be surprising, because if you want to have anything discretization independent with propagating degrees of freedom, you need always a non-local action. That under coarse graining, you naturally get a non-local action. There's a topological series, of course, if you coarse grain, they remain local. But of course, you can take the continuum limit. But a priori, it's not clear which measure to do. Also, if you do any calculations related to this thing, the parameters which appear here are always topological. So you can hope that this thing is kind of captured by any choice, any reasonable choice you do.
Okay, so I guess please.
I had a similar question to Rob. So, but I'm confused. Why would you expect or hope in the non-topological theory to get an exact invariance under change of triangulation?
These were just very special changes which kept the classical theory invariant.
But aren't these moves? By these moves, you can produce any change in triangulation.
Sorry?
aren't these moves sort of ergodic on the space of all triangulation?
Yeah, these are just the partner moves. So
partner moves. So if you were to have invariants under them,
yeah,
then
no,
you would have a full invariant.
There are three different types of the partner moves.
Yes.
And the action is only invariant on a two of them. And we only asked that it's even in, you can't even get invariants under one of them.
I see. But even if you could get both, that would only be a very limited sort of
triangulation.
So what's the physical?
But I would still claim that this would give you the most reasonable fixture on the measure.
And this would be a sort of handle
on the
right choice.
Yeah, and you might know more on these debates. Adjust. Any paper of the not so many papers I mentioned anything about the measure, I get funny referee reports, which are all kind of, no, I know what the best measure is from different people, different measures.
I see. So if we'd been lucky, it wouldn't give us the full triangulation invariance,
but
it would give us
yeah,
the answer.
And
to
more
the
importantly, it was suggested
question.
It was suggested that this could fix the measure in spin forms.
I see.
You know, but it doesn't work at least for Regic.
Okay, so let's thank Jan again.